If you turn back to Joshua 16, Joshua chapter 16, to that passage we read a little bit earlier in the service, we want to continue our look at the book of Joshua. Now, if you remember, Joshua is a book that is full of conquest, full of battles, full of war. And if I was just to divide this book into three simple sections, maybe it would help you. Chapter 1 to chapter 4 really deals with the section of entering the promised land of the nation to Israel, preparing themselves and entering the promised land. And then chapter 5 to chapter 12 deals with conquering the land, how they physically overcame the Canaanites in the land and took this land for themselves. And then chapter 13 to chapter 24 of this book, really the majority of this book, you could say, deals with the possessing of the land, how each individual tribe and family took their possession and came into the promised land as individuals and as families. Now, last week in chapter 15, or the week before last it was, I'm losing my bearings, we looked at the tribe of Ephraim, how they got their inheritance. And that's all set out for you in chapter 15. The chapter before dealt with Judah. So it started off, Judah got theirs first, then Ephraim, the second son of Joseph, and now Manasseh, the first son of Joseph, here in chapter 16, gets his inheritance. Now, although Manasseh, we mentioned this a few weeks ago, was the oldest son, he was not the one who received the greater blessing. Ephraim, the second son of Joseph, was the one that old Joseph prayed the blessing. Do you remember the story where he crossed his arms and prayed a greater blessing on Ephraim, using his right hand to signify that, over the left hand which he placed on Manasseh? Now, Manasseh, although he didn't receive as great a physical blessing as his younger brother Ephraim, he still got a blessing. Because old Jacob said, way, way back, if you read the story in the book of Genesis, that he will still be a great people. That's what he said. He'll not be as great as Ephraim, but Manasseh will be a great people. And he did become a great tribe and a great people. Now, Manasseh was the only tribe that has two plots of land as its inheritance. One on the east side of the Jordan River, and the other on the what we would call the mainland of the nation of Israel today. So that's where Manasseh had its inheritance. And although it wasn't as great a tribe as Ephraim, never was, never became, it did have some significance. There was at least two of the judges came from the tribe of Manasseh. If you remember, Gideon was from Manasseh. Jephthah, who's a little bit later on in the book of Judges, also was from the tribe of Manasseh. Now, the first thing we read about this Ephraim and Manasseh was in verse 5. We're told of Joshua chapter 16. And the border of the children of Ephraim went, according to their families, was thus even the border of their inheritance. Sorry, I'm in chapter 17, verse 3. But Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons, but daughters. And these are the names of his daughters, Malah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. Now, that may sound an irrelevant little piece of information. You say, well, why are they telling us about this family from the tribe of Manasseh who had just daughters? Well, if you go back in history to the book of Numbers, we won't take time to go through it, but if you would go back to Numbers 27, you will discover that this man, who has this long name, Zelophehad, he only had daughters, no sons. I remember when I grew up in Ireland in the church, there was two families in the church. They tended to have big families in those days. And one man in the church and his wife, they had seven sons, no daughters. And they kept going year after year, hoping to get a daughter, and they never got a daughter. The nice part of that story is I went back this year and I asked them, do you have any grandchildren? They said, yes. I says, how many? Two. I says, any granddaughters? They said, two granddaughters. So they waited all those years and they got eventually a granddaughter. But on the other side of the church, we had another family and they had seven daughters. No sons. I don't know why they didn't swap a few of them. The husband, he was very traditional. He was very upset with the wife, I remember, because after the seventh daughter, he blamed her. And he refused to talk to her for a couple of weeks because she had a seventh daughter. Well, this is a family here, Salufifad's family, that only had daughters. And they were concerned that their father's name would die out in the inheritance of the tribe of Manasseh. And they went to Moses and to the Lord and said, can you do something about this? And God spoke through Moses way back in Numbers 27. And God says, no, I will allow your daughters to carry the family name in your inheritance in the tribe of Manasseh. And here we are years later in Joshua chapter 17. And we discover that God has kept his promise to these daughters, to these women. And now they are receiving the plot of land that was to be their family plot. God kept his word. God honored his commitment. And Joshua honored the commitment that God and Moses had made to these women. You know, often people say that the Bible is against women. They say the Bible is a very chauvinistic book. You hear people say that. Silly people. Well, you'll discover that the Bible was never against women. The Bible has a different role for women than men, but the Bible has never dishonored women. In fact, the way the Jewish people handled this situation was way above any other civilization in honoring womanhood. And right throughout the scriptures, you'll see God has a very high place for women in the Old Testament as well as in the New Testament. And today, of course, in the New Testament church. Now, why do women have a high place in God's kingdom? Well, the answer is found way back at the beginning of the Bible in the book of Genesis. Because you'll discover that not only are we told that man was made in the image of God, but we're told God made them male and female. It's very clear, very interesting. Before he even created the female, it says he made them male and female in the image of God. So every woman has significance. Every child has significance. Every male, every female child has significance. Why? Every race has significance because every human who is created by God, male and female, black and white, Chinese, Indian, Malay, whatever race, whatever background or creed they're from, all have significance because all are made in the image of God. That's one of the blessing things. Now, I want to pass on from that. Verse 12 is where I want to focus in Joshua 17 of this story of the inheritance of the tribe of Manasseh. Because after receiving this long list of geographical places where they were given their inheritance, we read a similar story to the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Ephraim because it says, yet the children of Manasseh could not drive out the inhabitants of those cities, but the Canaanites would dwell in the land. And then verse 13 gives us a little bit more information. It says, yet it came to pass, when the children of Israel were waxen strong, that they put the Canaanites to tribute, but did not utterly drive them out. So here we have a familiar story, a familiar failure of the children of Israel in the Old Testament. They failed to do what God told them to do. They were given this big piece of land. In fact, Ephraim and Manasseh received a bigger chunk of land than any of the other tribes. They were given this great privilege. And yet here we have them failing to take the inheritance. And of course, verse 13 gives us this extra piece of information that they made the Canaanites that dwell there tribute nations. In other words, they made them servants. They made them to pay tax. They made them to work for the children of Manasseh and the children of Ephraim and the children of Judah in those territories. So it wasn't a lack of strength. It wasn't a lack of military ability. It was a lack of willingness to deal with the Canaanites in their midst. And God had said to them, you inherit this promised land, you drive out the Canaanites, and this is to be your land for an everlasting possession. But the children of Manasseh, what did they decide to do? They decided, number one, these Canaanites, we're not going to drive them out. In fact, we're going to let them stay in our midst. And not only are we going to let them stay in our midst, when they became strong and established in their territories, the children of Manasseh said, we'll make them work for us. Instead of dealing with them, instead of putting them out of the land of Canaan, they said, we'll keep them as tribute nations, as tribute slaves and servants unto us. Of course, you can't help but pick up the implication. Why did they allow them to remain? Because they wanted to use them for their own ends. They were more concerned with what? Money, materialism, getting cheaper servants than doing the will of God. And of course, there are many believers who are just the same. Now, these people fell short of what God said they should do. They feared initially to do what God said they should do. And again, notice the language in verse 12. It's very interesting. You'll pick the same language up in the previous chapter about Ephraim. The same language in the chapter before about Judah. The blame for failing to drive out the Canaanites is placed on the shoulders of the children of Manasseh. Do you see that? Yet, the children of Manasseh could not, or let me put it another way, would not, they wouldn't do it, drive out the Canaanites. It wasn't a lack in God. It wasn't a lack in God's promises. It wasn't a lack in God's willingness to help them drive them out. It was a lack of willingness in the children of Manasseh to face down all the Canaanites in their territories. Now, just a few chapters before, we read of an 85-year-old man. Do you remember the story? What was his name? Caleb. And Caleb conquered a whole city in Hebron, today called Hebron in Israel. He conquered that city by himself. And it was a city, the Bible tells us, had giants, not just one giant, but many giants that were in the city of Hebron. And old Caleb, 85 years of age, he got his sword on and he went up and took the city of Hebron and drove out the Canaanites that were there. But here we have Manasseh, a whole tribe with thousands of soldiers, and they're unwilling to do what God had called them to do. The failure is in them. They failed in faith. Let's put it where it belongs. Let's sum it up in a very simple way. They failed in faith to take the promise of God that it was their land given to them and to drive out the Canaanites that were in the land. And isn't it sad? Isn't it sad? Isn't it tragic? That these people in Manasseh, who had lived through all the journey from the wilderness, they had seen God open the Jordan River and bring them supernaturally through the Jordan River without even getting their feet wet. They had seen God bring down the walls of Jericho without them having to fire a shot in anger. They had seen God destroy the Canaanite armies of these large kingdoms and these large kings before their very eyes. They'd seen God do all those amazing things. In fact, many of them had lived for 40 years in the wilderness. And every morning they got up, there was manna from heaven on the ground. Every morning they got up, there was water coming out of the rock to assuage the thirst of 3 million people. They saw all these miracles, day by day, week by week. And yet, when God says, I only want you to drive out those remaining Canaanites in your territory, they failed to do it. They didn't have the faith. They didn't have the courage. And even when they became strong as a nation, as a tribe, verse 13 tells us, they decided for material gain, for their own pragmatic reasons. that they wouldn't do what God told them to do. And of course, they have a decision to make. And what's their excuse? Verse 14. And the children of Joseph, so Ephraim and Manasseh both failed. They both come along to this guy, Joshua. Now, who was Joshua? You have to remember the context of what's going on here. Joshua is from which tribe? Do you remember? Ephraim. He's a son of Joseph, from the two sons of Joseph. He's the leader of Israel. He's the one that God is using to give out this pieces of land, this inheritance to the 12 tribes. So they come to old Joshua, who's an old man now. No doubt thinking because he's from one of us, he's one of our tribes. He's one of our kith and kin. Blood is thicker than water, as we say. That old Joshua could easily be manipulated to give us an advantage over the other tribes. And here they come to Joshua, and of course it's an old sin, an old behavior that you see in human nature. And they said unto Joshua, verse 14, why hast thou given me but one lot and one portion to inherit, seeing I am a great people, for as much as the Lord hath blessed me hitherto? So here you get this insight into human character. When the human feels, when the human feels spiritually by faith, what do they do? Do they say to themselves, oh, I've made a mistake. I've lacked courage. I've lacked faith in God. I should be like old Caleb. I should go and conquer those territories and establish my inheritance. No. They come to Joshua and notice they're arrogant. They're proud. We are a great people. We're from Joseph. Remember, Joseph was the prime minister of Egypt. He wasn't a slave. There, Joseph's father-in-law was a very senior man in Egypt. We're from very royal bloodlines, powerful blood. We're not peasant farmers. We're the sons of Joseph. We were uniquely chosen as grandchildren of Jacob to receive tribal privilege, like our uncles. And they said to Joshua, now Joshua, give us some more. Now, where was Joshua? By the way, where was Joshua going to get any more land? The only place that Joshua could get any more land was to do what? Take it from the other 10 tribes. Isn't that right? Somebody was going to lose their inheritance that God had given them just to keep the face, the pride of Ephraim and Manasseh. And they come along to Joshua, and notice there's no thankfulness. They don't say, well, we want to say thank God for giving us this piece of land freely. We inherited from the Lord. We didn't build any of these cities. We didn't plant these vineyards. We didn't erect these homes. And we've been given this large piece of territory free of charge. Remember I said earlier, Ephraim and Manasseh got the two largest pieces of land in the nation of Israel. In fact, they got central pieces of land, not the north, not the south, where they're vulnerable to attack from other nations, but they got this large chunk of land on both sides of the Jordan. Largest piece of land compared to the other 10 tribes. And yet here they come, discontented, unhappy, whining, and wanting Joshua to take from the other tribes and give to them. And as I said, you see an awful trait of human character here. Because really what they're saying to Joshua is, Joshua, you have failed to treat us right. In fact, they're going a lot further than that. They're saying, God, who is behind the choice that Joshua is making, you haven't been fair to us. We're blaming you for the fact that we don't have even more land. Now, as I said, this is an old sin. Because if you go back to Genesis chapter 3, to the first man who ever lived on this earth, I want you to see something from Genesis chapter 3. Go way back to the very first human, the very first sinner, the very first fallen individual who ever walked this earth, who everyone in this room is related to. You may look around the room and say, I'm not related to that person. Yes, you are, through Adam and through Eve. And when you get back to Genesis chapter 3, you discover the awful story of how Adam and Eve fell from the perfect estate of grace that they were in by eating this forbidden fruit. Now, before we get to Genesis chapter 3, there's a little incident at the end of Genesis chapter 2. We have a situation where Adam is by himself. There's no woman at this point. The animals have male and female counterparts. And God gives Adam the privilege of naming all of these animals. And Adam no doubt notices as he sees there's male giraffe, a female giraffe, a male lion, a female lion, that there's no female Adam. There's no female human. Just one of him. And then God puts him to sleep, and from his rib and the flesh around the rib creates this woman, Eve. What does Adam say when he sees Eve? Verse 23 of Genesis chapter 2. He says, this is now. Now, our English translation doesn't really pick up the Hebrew very well. It can't. But really this expression, this is now, is a song. It's a piece of poetry. You could say this is the first love song that a man ever wrote about a woman. And this expression, this is now, really means like this. Wow! It's her, the woman, that I dreamt about. That's really what he's saying here. It sounds very bland, doesn't it? This is now. As I say, our English doesn't really pick up the depth of the Hebrew emotion here. It's much more graphic, much more colorful in the Hebrew. And Adam, when he sees Eve, he says, this is her. This is now. This is it. She, he says, is bone of my bones. Now, that doesn't sound very romantic to you, but Adam obviously felt that it did. You know, he said that she's flesh of me. She's one of me. She's part of me. And he went on to say, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife. Oh, that's what Adam longed to cleave. That word cleave means to glue together permanently in a permanent union. So that's how Adam reacted when God gave him Eve. He was full of joy. He was full of thankfulness. He's full of excitement. And I'm sure Eve was the most beautiful woman this world has ever seen. You say, how do I know that? Well, she had no imperfections. She didn't have to buy any of those skin creams or go for facials. She was a perfect specimen. She had no decay, deterioration. She probably, I'm saying probably, I believe she was the most beautiful woman, the most intelligent woman, the most brilliant woman that has ever walked this earth. And Adam was blown away by her. But then go to Genesis chapter 3. They took the fruit. We know the story, how the serpent tempted Eve. And verse 6 says, the woman saw that the tree was good for food. It was pleasant to the eyes and a tree to be desired to make one wise. She took of the fruit thereof and did eat. But she didn't stop there, because there's a comma. And gave also unto her husband with her. And then it says, and he did eat. Now let me ask you a question. Does it say that she took the fruit and forced it into his mouth? No. Does it say that the devil came along and grabbed Adam and held him down and Eve forced him to eat it? No. It says that she took the fruit, she ate the fruit, she gave it to Adam, and he, out of his own sovereign, willful choice, what? Ate the fruit. No one forced him. In fact, later in the New Testament, we're told he wasn't even fooled by the serpent. Only Eve was fooled by the serpent. He wasn't. He knew what he was doing. He saw through the temptation, but still took the fruit. And still ate it. Now, here's my point. What's Adam's reaction going to be when he has made this catastrophic spiritual failure in his life. Is he going to be repentant? Is he going to acknowledge what he has done wrong? Is he going to say, blame me, I'll take the blame. I'm the head of the home and I made this choice and I've done it out of my own free choice. Well, notice what happens when God comes and begins to speak to him. And God says in verse 11, skipping on, who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat? So God asks him a very direct question. Have you eaten of that tree which I told you you can't eat of, Adam? Yes or no? It's a very simple question. There's no third option here. It's either A or B. So what's Adam going to do? Notice how he replies. And the man said, the woman, oh, he knows who he's going to try to deflect the blame onto. The woman whom thou gavest. In other words, he says to God, she's to blame, but you're also to blame. You gave her to me. If you hadn't given her to me, I wouldn't have eaten. And if she hadn't given to me, I wouldn't have eaten either. Both of them are to blame. See how Adam frames this? He starts off by refusing to accept the burden of the blame for eating the fruit. God asked Adam, notice the question, hast thou eaten? You. I'm not talking about Eve. I'm not talking about the serpent. I'm asking you, Adam. And Adam's instinctive fallen reaction is to deflect the blame onto Eve. And notice how he puts it. The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me. She forced me. She persuaded me. Now, when Adam first met Eve, do you remember in chapter 2? He didn't call her the woman. He called her Eve. You remember? Well, he didn't call her. He called her bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. He said, this is her. This is the one I've been waiting for. Now he says, the woman, huh? Whom thou gavest. She was the one who gave to me. So she's to blame and you're to blame. And then at the very end of the sentence, he says, and I did eat. Just put himself down as a very small portion of the blame. 99% is God and Eve. And then there's one little percent. Adam says, well, you've caught me and I have to say, I just did eat. Okay, but it was a small thing. My part of it was very, very small. And don't you see the same here with Manasseh? Coming to Joshua because of a failure they have made to drive out the Canaanites. And who do they blame? Joshua. They say, Joshua, you didn't give us enough land. We deserve a bigger piece. We are a great nation. We're the sons of Joseph. And Joshua, you owe us more. You're to blame for this reason. You didn't give us a good enough piece. You give us a piece of land where the Canaanites are very hard and very difficult and very entrenched. And really also what they're saying, like old Adam, they're saying, God, you're to blame because you are the one who chose to give that land through Joshua. Rather than face up to where the blame should be on themselves, this tribe of Ephraim is a tribe that's trying, and Manasseh, of course, as well, are trying to blame others for their own failures. And let me tell you this, you'll find that so true in your Christian life. You know, whenever you have a spiritual failure, a lack of faith, a lack of walking with God in your life, you know the first person you should blame? You go to the mirror in the bathroom and you look at that mirror and you'll find that person because you'll be looking at it. The greatest enemy you have is yourself. No one forces you to sin. You ever think about that? We try to blame everything. We blame our circumstances. We blame our spouses. We blame our parents. We blame society. Say, oh, it's very stressful here, and I can't control myself. And they got all these lists of reasons people have to blame why they are the way they are. And at the end of the day, the person to blame is yourself. If you're honest, nobody's forcing you to act that way. Nobody's forcing you to talk that way. Nobody's forcing you to have that attitude. You choose to behave in those ways. Yes, there are other people who influence you. Yes, there are temptations there. We understand that. We're not foolish. But at the end of the day, where the rubber hits the road, as the old expression goes, you're the one that makes the choice. You're the one that makes the decision. There are too many Christians who run about trying to blame other people for their own failures. Just like the tribe of Manasseh. And they're not even just blaming, they're very proud. I am a great people, I am a spiritual person, but this person is affecting me. This person insulted me. This person didn't do what I wanted them to do. This person irritates me. Well, wasn't the Lord Jesus Christ insulted, offended, betrayed? Didn't his 12 disciples run away from him? And one of them even went and sold him for a few pieces of silver into the hands of his enemies? Did he give in to temptation because of all that? No. Joseph was down in Egypt, betrayed by his 10 siblings, the most awful, hurtful betrayal a person could ever endure, his own flesh and blood. Wanted to murder him and then sold him as a slave. And then when he was down in Egypt, he worked very hard and got himself promoted by the grace of God to the head of Potiphar's household. And then Potiphar's wife, because he wouldn't sin, betrayed him again. And he found himself languishing in a prison for 2 years. And then when he was in the prison, the chief butler and the chief baker, who he helped and interpreted their dreams, they also betrayed him, especially the butler, forgot about him, left him there. Did Joseph blame others? Did Joseph get bitter? Did Joseph use that as an excuse to sin? No. In fact, every great test that came to Joseph's life, what did he do? He rose above the test and his circumstances and said, I'll keep walking with God. I'll keep my testimony. I won't use my circumstances as an excuse to sin against the Lord. Oh, we have a lot of excuses. Old Billy Sunday, who was a famous evangelist in the 19th century, he said, an excuse, he said, is like a sausage. You know what a sausage is? It's the skin, and then they stuff it full of meat. Or they call it meat. I don't know what, I think there's not much meat in some of them, but let's say it's full of meat for the sake of the metaphor. Old Billy Sunday once brought a sausage, and he said, an excuse is a skin of a reason stuffed with a lie. That's a good way of putting it, isn't it? That's all it is. It's just a lie with a little covering called a reason to hide the lie. And that's what Manasseh was doing here. It was just a lie. We're a great people and you haven't given us enough. God had given them enough. In fact, they could have gone eastwards. If they wanted to expand their territories, they could have conquered more nations to the east of them. They had that position. They had that right under God's law. But the excuse was, oh, you didn't give us enough. What's also in this statement, I think, is what? Covetousness. You see that? Even though they had the largest territory, Ephraim and Manasseh, even though they had one of the choicest pieces of territory, Ephraim and Manasseh, they still wanted more, didn't they? Still weren't happy. Oh, that's an old sin, isn't it, as well, of human nature? Who were our first parents? Adam and Eve. Where did God put Adam and Eve? In the Garden of Eden. Now, what was the Garden of Eden? It was a perfect environment. We have this word in English, paradise, to describe Eden, because that's what it was like. It was perfect. They didn't have to work by the sweat of their brow. They had to just do a little bit of playing around with the plants, dressing them and keeping them. But they had no hard labor there. They had everything free there. The atmosphere was perfect. They had no decay in their bodies. They had a perfect marriage, a perfect relationship one with another. And even better, they had a perfect relationship with God. Everything was paradise. Was there any reason to be unhappy there? No. Was there any reason to be discontented there? No. And yet the old serpent came into that garden in Genesis chapter 3, and he began to talk to Eve, and he said to Eve, "Yea, hath God said, I wonder, can you eat of every tree of the garden?" He was just trying to see with the questions, was she a little bit discontented? Was there a little spurt of unhappiness there, that there was something missing that she wasn't allowed to do? And sure enough, Satan picked up. Eve was a little bit unhappy with God. She couldn't eat of all the trees. Even though he'd given her hundreds of thousands of trees, no doubt millions of trees to eat, more than she could ever fill of her belly. All kinds of fruits, all kinds of trees. And yet, there was one tree she couldn't eat. And she couldn't accept it. She was discontented. And she coveted that tree. And the old devil said to her, "You know, God knows that if you eat that fruit, you will be like God. You'll be greater than what you are." In other words, he was feeding the discontentment in her spirit. You can be greater. God is keeping something from you. God is actually jealous of you, Eve. And that's what's happening here with Manasseh. They're looking at the other tribes and they're saying, "Oh, I want more. I'm not happy with what God has given me. I think I deserve better." Maybe you're here today and you're thinking the same way. You look at your siblings. You look at your contemporaries in school, university, in the workplace. You look at the way they look physically. You look at the qualifications they have. You look at the positions they have compared to you. And you say, "I'm not happy. I got the unlucky gene." You hear people talk like that. "I missed out. God's not fair." Well, anytime you start to think like that, you will hear in the back of your mind the hiss of the old serpent, because that's what he's feeding, the discontentment. Anger with God, jealousy, covetousness. You see, at the root of covetousness is this problem, pride. Why is it pride? Because pride says, "I can do a better job than God. If I was God, I would do it differently. If I was God, I could handle this better." What's that? That's pride. That's arrogance. And really, that's what Ephraim is doing here. It's coming to Joshua and to God and saying, "You didn't give me enough. You didn't give me what I want. I could do a better job than you. Old Joshua, get off the throne, and God, get off the throne, and Ephraim and Manasseh, we'll handle this better than you can." That's what they're saying. Now, how is Joshua going to react to this? I mean, this is his kith and kin. And these people are very loyal to their tribes. Remember, you know, blood's thicker than water. Joshua is an old man, and he has children and grandchildren, no doubt, who are going to need to maintain good relationships in the future within the tribe. And there's going to be a temptation for Joshua here to say, "You know, I'm the senior man here. I can actually tweak this a little bit and give them a bit more land and take some from some other tribe. I'm powerful enough. I'm senior enough. I'm respected enough to get away with this." But you see, Joshua is made of better stuff. What does Joshua say? Verse 14, after they said, verse 15, "And Joshua answered them, If thou be a great people," you call yourselves great? Well, let me take you at your own words. "If thou be a great people." Now, by the way, at the end of verse 14, you notice how they throw in this little spiritual thing. "For as much as the Lord hath blessed me hitherto." You know, after, to hide all the jealousy and all the pride and all the arrogance and all the deflection, they throw in this little spiritual little piece of statement. You know, "God has blessed. We're the sons of Joseph. We get a double blessing." Well, tried to mask what's really going on. But Joshua's not fooled by it all. Joshua says, "If you're a great people." He doesn't even say, "Since you're a great people." He uses a conditional. "If you say you're great, Yeah? I'm not accepting that, Joshua says, but you're saying it. You're making the statement. You're claiming to be a big shot, a big people with big mouths and a big nation. Well, here, let me tell you. Get thee up to the wood country. You get up and do some work. And cut down for thyself there in the land of the Perizzites and of the giants, if Mount Ephraim be too narrow for thee. In other words, Joshua says, get up and claim it. Stop whining. Stop boasting about how great you are. Go and prove it. Go and establish it. Let your achievements do the talking. That's what you need to say to a lot of Christians. Don't talk about how mature you are. Practice it. Don't tell people how spiritual you are. Start living it. Don't tell people that you're a child of God with the Holy Spirit in you and you're a spiritually powered person. Go and demonstrate it. Be different. Prove it in the home. Live out the gospel in the workplace. Don't deflect the blame. Don't try to hide behind someone else or some other situation. Go and do it. That's what Joshua basically told them. And he even says, go to the land of the giants. Oh, Caleb, he's 85 years of age. He's already shown you it's possible. Go you and do it. Caleb didn't say he's a great man. You notice Caleb just said, I wholly follow the Lord. Give me whatever you want to give me, Joshua, and I'll go and deal with whoever's there in God's name and in God's power. And Joshua gave him Hebron, a city of giants. And he says, okay, I'll go and do it. And he did it. These people, they said, oh, we're a great people and we deserve a big, big inheritance. And Joshua says, well, there's a piece there. It's full of trees. Go and cut them down. Get to work. And then there's a city there beside it. It's full of giants. You go and handle them. Oh, Caleb could handle them. Why can't you? Joshua didn't get down and have a pity party with them. Do you notice? He told them straight. He told them logically. He told them fairly. He was just. You think you're great? And what did they say? Verse 16, you'd think that the next verse would say, the children of Manasseh and Ephraim said, yes, you're right, Joshua, we are a great people, we have a great God, and now we're going to go and claim this inheritance for ourselves. If old Caleb could do it, if God could take care of us at Jericho, if God could take care of us at the Jordan River and in the wilderness, God can help us to deal with these small little cities and cut down this wood and establish our territory. That's what we would expect to happen, wouldn't we? That's what should have happened. But instead, old human nature kicks in again. They've been humbled by Joshua. You can imagine. They walk into that court or that tent where Joshua is. No doubt there's other people there. And they say to Joshua, we want more land. We're a great people. And really, we're saying to Joshua, we're your kith and kin, Joshua. Nod and a wink. We're of the same tribe, Joshua. And Joshua looks at them in front of everybody and says, yeah, you're so great. Go and prove it. Go and do it. There's plenty of opportunity for you to demonstrate how spiritually great you are and physically great you are. Go ahead. And God go with you. But instead, the reaction is what? And the children of Joseph said, the hill is not enough for us. Here they go again. Oh, we need more. And all the Canaanites that dwell in the land of the valley have chariots of iron. Oh, dear. Both they who are off Bethshean and her towns and they that are off the valley of Jezreel. In other words, they say, we can't do this. This is too much. Now, hadn't old Caleb just taken a city of giants? Hadn't God just brought down the walls of Jericho? Hadn't God just moved the Jordan River apart to let them go through? Hadn't they been living for 40 years with manna and water out of the rock? Hadn't God provided every step of the way? Hadn't God taken care of them every step of the way? And here they are, just a few chariots of iron, and they can't take them. Here's another what? Lie stuffed in the skin of a reason. That's all it is, an excuse. A pathetic excuse. Is Joshua going to give in just because they whine the second time? What does Joshua say? Verse 17. Thou art a great people and hast great power. Thou shalt not have one lot only, but the mountain shall be thine. For it is a wood And thou shalt cut it down, and the outgoings of it shall be thine. For thou shalt drive out the Canaanites, and though they have iron chariots, and though they be strong. Joshua just says to them, God will drive them out if you're willing to do it. I'm not going to change the other boundaries just to let you have your way. Go and prove your calling. Go and prove God in this situation. You go. You demonstrate that you really are a great people. Don't be afraid of the hard work. And you know, let me bring this to a conclusion. That's the same for you and I. We can't just say, I'm a Christian. You know what the name Christian means? Christ one. That's what it means. I'm one that belongs to Christ. I'm united to Him. Well, if you say you're a Christian, go and live as a Christian. What is a Christian? Someone who's different from the world. You be different in the home. You have a different marriage. You have a different way of bringing up your children. You have a different attitude to work as an employer or as an employee. You have a different attitude to people that you meet. You talk a different language. You walk a different walk. You dress a different way. You think a different way. You go and be a Christian. You say you're a Christian. Don't run around looking for excuses to blame your own conduct. Go and live the Christian life. And don't boast about your achievements. Go and demonstrate your achievements. If you go to the city of London today, you'll see a great cathedral right in the heart of London. What's it called? St. Paul's Cathedral. Many years ago, there was a brilliant scientist and mathematician called Sir Christopher Wren. And he decided he would apply his maths and physics skills to architecture. He designed over 50 churches in London, and the greatest church he designed was St. Paul's Cathedral, that's still standing to this day. Now, you would imagine that a man who built not just 50 churches, but built Trinity College, Cambridge, and Hampton Court Palace, and all these other places, that this man would have a tremendous statue to himself and a tremendous plaque on the wall describing all of his achievements. In fact, if you go to St. Paul's Cathedral, there's just a tiny little plaque where he's buried in St. Paul's Cathedral. And in Latin, it translates this. This is what it says if you translate it from the Latin. If you seek His memorial, look all around you. That's what it says. Look all around you. In other words, if you want to see what this man has achieved, look at his achievements. His legacy speaks for itself. And I say the same to you today. Don't boast. Don't say, I'm a great person. I'm a great people. God owes me a big living. No. Be like Sir Christopher Wren. Build your legacy by doing the things of God. And let your legacy speak for itself. Leave a testimony behind in your home, in your workplace, and in your church that others will miss your passing and witness your passing by what you have left behind. That's what you must do. That's what I must do. Did the sons of Joseph learn their lesson? Ephraim and Manasseh? Sadly, they didn't. You'll discover that in the book of Judges, the hill of Ephraim became a place of idolatry. You'll discover right through the book of Judges and into the first book of Kings that the tribes that continually sought to assert themselves, boast about themselves, see themselves as superior, were Ephraim and Manasseh. And of course, it culminated in the great split in the nation when the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah were split into two separate kingdoms. And who led the split? The Ephraimites. In fact, the northern kingdom of the 10 northern tribes was often referred to in the Bible as the kingdom of Ephraim.
They didn't learn their lesson. They didn't do the work God said they should do. Instead, they continued to boast in themselves, regard themselves as superior to others, and saw that God owed them a living for a living. And in the end, they destroyed their testimony. And they were swept off into captivity in the first great Assyrian captivity. Didn't learn it. You make sure you learn your lesson from the tribe of Manasseh and the tribe of Ephraim. They say a great people. You're a great people. You come from a great faith. You're a child of the King. You have a great God. Live up to that calling. Let us pray. Our Father, we thank Thee and praise Thee for who Thou art. We thank Thee, Lord, for even this Joshua chapter 17, a chapter that reminds us it's not enough to talk the talk. We must walk the walk. It's not enough to claim to be great. We must demonstrate that we are great. Our achievements must be our legacy of walking with Thee. This tribe of Ephraim and this tribe of Manasseh failed because they didn't have the faith. They didn't have the willingness to do what Thou calls them to do. May that not be true of us as a church, as a family, and as an individual. Give us Thy grace to walk with You. For we ask these things in Jesus' precious name. Amen.